there! You are listening to the Conservation Spotlight, a regular segment of Willamette Wake Up on KMUZ Community Radio, 88.5 and 100.7 FM, and streaming at KMUZ.org. This is where Marion and Polk Soil and Water Conservation Districts and OSU Small Farms Program shine a light on partnerships and programs that conserve our beautiful natural resources in the Willamette Valley. We're illuminating our collective mission of conserving soil, water, and natural resources for urban and agricultural audiences in the Willamette Valley. I am your host, Morgan Neal, Outreach Coordinator with the Polk Soil and Water Conservation District. Today, I'm talking with Joe Scott, Program Director for the Traditional Ecological Inquiry Program with the Long Tom Watershed Council. I'm happy to introduce Joe to everyone today on Conservation Spotlight to have this really exciting conversation about cultural burning in the Valley. So welcome to the podcast, Joe.
Thank you very much.
Yeah. Joe, we first got to know each other through a colleague, Suzanne Teller, Outreach Coordinator for the Lucky-Mute Watershed Council. And I understand you participated in a cultural burn demonstration that she helped to organize. And long story short, Polk SWCD got looped into the snowball of what became the cultural burn event at our property, Smithfield Oaks. And after I got the chance to talk with you, I thought this person has a lot of passion for their work, and I really want to support what you're doing and share that with the wider audience. So I would love to begin with a little introduction. If you could share a little bit about yourself, your background, and what drove you toward doing the work that you do.
Yeah, I can do that. So yeah, my name is Joe Scott. Joe Scott, Nishi, Srinis, it's a beautiful day here on Kalapuya-Ilahi. So I'm an enrolled member of the Confederated Tribes of Siletz Indians, little outside my ecological homeland. My ancestors are Tequelma people and rogue tribes from southwestern Oregon. Another very oak savanna dependent culture. So there's a lot of similarities between our cultural practices, our ecological management tools. So yeah, I have been an educator for my entire life. I grew up with educators. Both my parents were school teachers. I taught on the reservation in Siletz for years. And then after working with our tribal youth, became very interested in the ecological foundation of our education and moved into the valley and started working with folks from Long Tom and other tribal educators and came up with the Traditional Ecological Inquiry Program.
Wonderful. Yeah. So you have teaching in your DNA, and I think that really makes sense with what you're doing now and being able to pass on that knowledge. Part of the reason that I wanted to chat with you today is to get a dialogue going about fire. And I want to expand our listeners' understanding of fire. So maybe we can start with, you know, some background in the history of fire in the Valley.
Definitely an important thing for all of the residents here in the Valley to know a little bit about. You know, you're on the homeland. We're all here on the homeland of the Kalapuya people, who are a fire-adapted culture, historically and more as we move forward with this larger fire ecology understanding that's developing in the indigenous and non-indigenous communities. The history of fire, I have the awesome honor of working with some really amazing scholars and historians and cultural leaders in Siletz and Grand Ronde and other tribes. My understanding of the history of fire in the valley is that, you know, since they call it time immemorial, but, you know, we tell stories so we about the past and sort of do remember it in a lot of ways. In any case, you know, we're a, again, fire adapted culture, and the landscape here in the valley and the people, you know, are part of a larger community. And so we've worked together since time immemorial to manage the land for that beautiful oak savanna that we're familiar with here in the valley, the shrinking, continuing to shrink oak savanna habitat. The grassland has been managed with fire. The oak trees themselves have been managed with fire. All kinds of different fire, lots of fire diversity, whether it's burning for, you know, fresh grass, for browsing animals, to, you know, pest management, which was sort of the work we were doing there at Smithfield Oaks. You know, cultural fire and fire adapted communities also use fire in ceremony and, you know, in medicine and all of the things that fire is good for. I think sometimes those aspects of cultural fire get left out of the discussion. But yeah, so managing, you know, food and resources and materials on a landscape scale has been, you know, the practice until settler colonial influences greatly reduced our fire traditions.
Yeah, I was wondering if you could maybe expand a little bit on some of the ecological benefits for bringing fire to the landscape, and maybe also touching on the acorn weevil.
The acorn weevil, wow. Ecological benefits. There's, I think, one thing we have to keep in mind is that, you know, we're part of that ecology. So, you know, what is the benefit to the human animals, you know, the human people, the insect relatives, the bird relatives, all of the animals, you know, what is the ecological benefit? You know, it's the same, you know, larger picture benefit of all of the elements, you know, the water, the earth, the air. Fire's right there, keeping things balanced. So in a very literal sense, fire takes, you know, leaf litter and overgrowth, grassland, and it takes the nutrients that are tied up in those things and returns the nutrients to the soil in the form of ash and charcoal. So it adds nutrients back to the soil. The smoke can be used in everything from pest management to shading rivers for the salmon, to cool the water for salmon. The ecological benefits go on and on. You know, shaking those oak trees around a little bit to get the flowers pollinated. As far as, you know, you asked specifically about the acorn weevil, that actually comes from some research I've done as part of my Indigenous plate keeping artists fellowship that I got through the Grand Ronde tribe. And part of the work I've been doing there is working to understand some of this fire ecology, working to understand some of the practices, the ceremony, the ceremonial objects, the fire starting, the way people have worked with fire. And a lot of our knowledge comes from our neighbors and relatives to the south, you know, in the Klamath country, where folks have been burning on their homeland, you know, since humans have been there. And there was research that I read about where fire was being used at night to attract a moth that comes out, you know, a moth. It's very similar to the acorn weevil in the sense that it's, you know, it's an insect that goes inside the acorn. There's a little worm in there. It eats the nut meat and makes them inedible for humans. So the trick with them is to burn at night, and then all the moths just fly into the fire. So that seemed like a great idea. I thought, wow, you know, this means burning in the summertime. That's a great time to get together. You know, the nights are short. We can have an evening of it. And then turns out there's no moths here. There's no moths in the Willamette Valley. You know, the insect that gets into the acorns here in the Willamette Valley are the acorn weevils. And turns out that they actually live in the soil for 2 to 3 years, according to my botanist and my, you know, insect knowledgeable friends. Those come out at night as well, in the summer. So makes sense, to be working with the fire in that same context. So that's a lot of the thinking, a lot of the science, a lot of the indigenous knowledge behind it. And I think for a lot of us, it's in our hearts. You know, we just know that, you know, from notes in researchers' or notes in, you know, like soldiers' journals describe fires going on in the summer. All year round, people were using fire for various reasons, which makes perfect sense. You know, if fire's there, fire's a tool. So, anyway, you know, it's all part of a larger picture.
Absolutely. And maybe we should backtrack a second and do a quick clarification on the difference between prescribed burning and cultural burning. Could you maybe clarify that for our listeners and the difference?
Absolutely. This conversation happens a lot, particularly as, you know, tribal practitioners are in these prescribed fire spaces where the conversations are happening. And, you know, I think that really the key difference is that, you know, prescribed fire, it's right there in the word, prescribed, you know, it's written out in advance. There's a very frequently a very elaborate and agency-oriented document that goes with the burn, you know, that's there to guide all of the different agencies that are frequently involved in a prescribed fire. Cultural fire, you know, there's land management practices with that prescribed fire. A lot of times it's related to fire mitigation, timber resources. It's oriented to managing for, you know, timber resources really frequently. And cultural fire is fire that's used in a cultural context. So it's for building community. It's for tending those delicious first foods. It's for making sure that the materials we use for our basketry is good and straight and, you know, the sticks are nice. So yeah, cultural fires for cultural purposes. So that's the key difference. You know, it's a lot of times it's community consensus. It's not really written up in a document. It's about, you know, what are the needs of the community? What do people want to see? What are the agreed upon goals?
You talked about working with different agencies, you know, such as ours, Solon Water Conservation District. How is it that you bridge the traditional knowledge and contemporary insight on fire? And maybe along the same vein, can you touch on some of the challenges in changing the narrative on fire and working with non-Indigenous organizations?
I think the you know, a lot of this is just my personal thinking, my insights on what I see happening. The history of prescribed fire is in fire suppression. So the approach to prescribed fire in the agency sense is about suppression. It's about using fire as a tool in fire suppression. Which means that narrative is about making fire bad. It's about fire being ultimately the enemy. The term fighting fire with fire, right? It has fighting in there. We're not fighting fire, we're working with fire. You know, fire is a part of our community. So, you know, painting it as an enemy has actually been part of the larger narrative of Native American people. You know, being marginalized, our traditional tending practices, not being understood, and vilified. So, you know, the approaches are just completely different. So, you know, bridging those two lines of thinking is an ongoing process, and it seems to happen on an individual level. individual people in conversation, just being in a place and watching these things happen, that's really what seems to make the difference.
Yeah, I noticed at the cultural burn event that, there was time for group discussion, and then I also saw a lot of individual conversations that you were having too.
Yeah, there was a lot of co-teaching. There was a lot of amazing learning opportunities there.
Yeah, just a quick update if you're just joining us. I'm here with Joe Scott, Program Director for the Traditional Ecological Inquiry Program with the Long Tom Watershed Council. And you're listening to Conservation Spotlight, a regular segment of Willamette Wake Up on KMUZ Community Radio, 88.5 and 100.7 FM, and streaming on KMUZ.org. So now I would like to shift the conversation a little bit, and focus a little bit more on the TEIP program. Again, that's Traditional Ecological Inquiry Program, and how you're using fire as a tool for engaging and building community.
The Traditional Ecological Inquiry Program really came together as the shared vision of folks at the Long Tom Watershed Council, really very specifically Katie McKendrick and some other folks. David Lewis was part of that initial conversation, Grand Ronde tribal member and scholar. A lot of folks really got behind this thinking, this brainstorming. What we came up with was an ITEC based, Indigenous traditional ecological knowledge based college, career, and community readiness program for Indigenous youth. And we started working with youth in the winter of 2017. And in those first meetings, we visited we have a 200 acre classroom, basically. South of Eugene. And on our first visits, we looked at all the overgrowth, all of the grass and overgrown meadows, and looked at it and we're like, this landscape needs fire. And the work started. And the Long Tom Watershed Council, wow, time out, because like there are so many people. I'm trying to think. But yeah, college and career readiness program for tribal youth. Our first cohort started out there at our classroom in the winter of 2017. We really follow the lead of Indigenous youth and began very quickly realizing that this program needed to incorporate families and the larger tribal community in response to the needs of tribal youth. And working with tribal youth means, in an ecological context, including everyone, including, not just the land itself and these cultural practices, but families, community. And as time has gone by, the program has grown to include a number of families. We continue to do outreach to the tribal community and include new interns. Some of our interns have been with us for the full 5 years. It's a constantly evolving and growing program.
I love that. Yeah, and on our website we'll share a link for people to find out more about the program. The TEIP is a great platform for learning, but the teaching encompasses more than just fire. What else are your interns gaining from participating, and what are the overarching goals of the program?
That's a great question. The overarching goals are to offer pathways to success for Indigenous youth, whatever that looks like, whatever they see themselves doing. By way of example, one of our interns was able to do research into their family's history here in what is now Western Oregon, dug into that family history and found information on proper techniques for cooking camas. And that became a passion of theirs. And they were able to research not only that family history, but the technology involved in making a traditional camas oven, how the process works, and actually created a camas oven. And we've
Very
been
cool.
having a camas bake, although we call it a camas burn. Long story there. In any case, then took that experience, wrote a beautiful article, ended up in High Country News, this intern of ours, and then
Awesome.
leapfrogged into a career in stewardship. So that's a pathway to success. And I just think that's a really great example of how the program can really work for people.
I love that. Yeah. At the cultural burn event before we got fire even on the ground, you invited attendees to share stories about fire and burning. And I'm wondering, what role does storytelling play in building relationships with the land?
I'm really glad you asked that part. It's hard to contain my thoughts on that one, just perfectly honestly. So many of our stories about fire include this amazing information, this amazing insight on how human people work with fire. These are, some of these are ancient stories, and they tell us, what materials to use in a fire drill. Like how to start fire, what to use as materials. I used, an old story had a recipe for making glue in it. So not only are there literal references to fire, fire ecology, fire technology in our stories, but in this more contemporary context, sharing stories is really about getting to know other people's diverse fire experience. The tribal knowledge of all of these diverse communities comes to these opportunities to share and practice. And we learn about other tribes' fire traditions. There are so many nuanced ways that tribes have interacted with fire, tribal communities have worked with fire. Everything from those stories you're talking about to the importance of gender roles, all of those, all of those things, people bring to these experiences, share. It's always a good conversation when people start talking about, their experiences with fire. It's really important to mention too that there are so many people out there who've had really impactful bad experiences with fire, and whether that's a house fire, a fire injury to entire communities burning down. Those are part of the fire story too, particularly the modern one, 150 years into settler colonial fire suppression. We have fire stories where the air is full of smoke for a week. We have fire stories where people get hurt. And those stories are important to share too. A lot of times, those stories are the first things people think about, particularly in the non-Indigenous community, in our shared experience here in the Pacific Northwest and across the West, with wildfire, and the consequences of climate change, and again, 150 years of settler colonial fire suppression.
Yeah, absolutely. I would agree that is important part in talking about fire, as a whole and in changing the dialogue. You have to talk about both sides of it. And for our listeners that are, really engaged in what you're talking about and want to support the Traditional Ecological Inquiry Program, are there things that they can do to support your work?
I think we're always looking for partners. We call them shared landscapes, but places that Indigenous people can access. And when I say access, I mean lifelong access, intergenerational access, like our work there at the Smithfield Oaks property. The work that went into that was really contingent on the relationship building or the relationship that will provide this place, this oak ecology, this experience, ongoing, a continuing opportunity to go there, to, use fire as a management tool, and to gather acorns, tend oak trees for delicious acorns. So that's
Absolutely.
one thing. And of course, we're always looking for financial support. That's definitely a thing. We depend 100% on grant funding and whatever fundraising we can do. And it's worth mentioning, I think, that the grant funding cycle, for those of you who are folks who are familiar with how grant funding works, know that funding a program happens on like a 1 to 3 year scale. And we're making these promises to tribal youth, to tribal families, to the tribal community that we have this ongoing access and we're engaging the land in these committed ways. And it's difficult to maintain those things on a grant funded cycle, because that grant funding runs out, you're chasing more funding. And a lot of the work is about maintaining the funding. So worth mentioning.
Yeah. We'll put your contact information with the new episode so people can follow up with you.
That'd be great.
Yeah, if you could ask the community to make one change in relation to the work that you do, what would that be?
I think the thing that I'm seeing is that those through relationship building, through conversations, through one-on-one, through those, one family at a time, conversations, that kind of work, people are coming around and recognizing that there is inherent value to putting Indigenous ecological knowledge on the land. And just coming to that understanding, recognizing that this work is important, not just for tribal people who are engaging in this way, but for the larger community that's worried about wildfire, that's concerned about, the quality of our air, or there are folks who are concerned about, the health of our salmon, the water. So I think just keeping an open mind, having a broader understanding, doing the work to understand what's going on. So I don't
Absolutely.
know. Is that one thing?
That works. Thank you so much. Yeah. I want to thank you, Joe, for taking the time to chat with me today. I really appreciate it. And I hope that we can work together again in the near future.
Definitely, we will be.
Okay,
Come
good.
October, right?
Yes, acorn
Burn
week.
it
Yeah,
again.
absolutely. I've been talking with Joe Scott about cultural burning in the Willamette Valley, and I feel like we have just scratched the surface on this topic. So much more to talk about. I'm your host, Morgan Neal, Outreach Coordinator for the Polk Soil and Water Conservation District. Thank you for taking a few minutes to share the light with us. We are grateful for a community of conservation-minded folks who know the importance of partnerships. If you would like more information on any of these topics and upcoming events, please visit our website, polkswcd.com, and our Facebook page for follow-up information. And if you liked what you heard here on the Conservation Spotlight, tune in next month to KMUZ at 100.7 or 88.5 FM, the third Wednesday of every month during Willamette Wake Up. Thank you for listening and your light shining.